I'm Christopher Leiden. This is Open Source from the Watson Institute at Brown University, this time from London, where our friends at the hip online global magazine called Open Democracy are thinking out loud about the new media. Who's listening? Who's reading? Will they pay for the pleasure of it? And is the content on all these uncredentialed sites credible in the end? My conversations here are with some of the conferees who made waves or just made sense, starting with Mark Hunter, an American teacher at the University of Paris, who is worried about something like a faith-based takeover of the popular media. And then John Lloyd of the business-based Financial Times, who worries about the dwindling audience for reality. And then Masha Lipman gives a very thoughtful and frank dissenter's view from Moscow. She says that in Russia, you can see an internet society beginning to grow and thrive without having any effect on the totalitarian trend of politics and real life. Mark Hunter, you're our American in Paris, and it's your view that the trendsetters in the business of journalism, oddly enough, are Rupert Murdoch, the right-wing press lord, and Michael Moore, the left-wing movie maker. How does this happen? How does this work out?
Well, I think what's happening is that these guys are showing us the emergence of different ways of relating to an audience. And this isn't the only model, but it does tell us some things about how journalism can develop and how it can get new publics and how it can build communities that are both providing content and taking content from the media.
Tell us how.
Well, neither of them is taking a stance as a neutral arbiter. They're taking the risk of being identified with specific currents, and that risk is paying. On other levels, there are other people who are doing the same thing for different communities. There are environmental groups and environmental news services that are addressing the needs of those communities. And you see this kind of, on the one hand, fragmentation and diversification going on, but you see a different relationship taking place between journalists and the public. And my question is how investigation can fit into that matrix.
Are you saying that this kind of community-based, network-connected news club, so to speak, is the future?
It's part of the future. That certainly doesn't mean that general media are doomed or the newspapers are doomed. It does mean that there will be different publics and different approaches to treating them. And, you know, all the research we have on how people consume news and information shows that the public is really a lot more divided than we thought. Now, I'm not saying that we need to take a cynical marketing approach to targeting these publics. I am saying that much more of the future of journalism is going to be, well, in some ways it'll look like a throwback to the past because we'll have people who are coming out of, you know, partisan backgrounds or people who are coming out of organizational backgrounds, for example, union journalism, which was one of the origins of the modern newspaper.
Yep.
We'll see throwbacks to that kind of stuff. But, you know, hopefully there are going to be throwbacks that are going to allow people to do better work instead of simply being the captives of the communities. But that's going to be a hard row to hoe.
John Lloyd of the Financial Times, this sounds like faith-based journalism, church linked journalism. The FT surely stands for reality-based journalism. Where does the claim for truth, objectivity, worldliness, reality stand in this new world?
I mean, I think as a description of what is happening, I think Mark is very right in many ways. I think, though, I mean, one has to say, as he said himself, how new is it? I mean, if you think of, well, two or three days ago, William Buckley died. Buckley was the great figure of right-wing journalism, created in some ways a way of looking at America through a certain kind of journalism. John Reed, whom people still think of as a great describer of the origins of the Soviet Union, you know, had a very large audience. So you've had partisans with very strong audiences, and you will have them in the future. So that Michael Moore and Murdoch's people at Fox News come in a long tradition, very long tradition. I mean, going right back perhaps to the pamphlets of the 17th century and the news sheets of the 17th century. What I think is the interesting area is whether or not journalism which is affiliated to a certain point of view, and in the case certainly of Moore, but also of others, including many of the people on Fox News, that this is the dominant way, even in some extreme versions, the only way to get facts across. In other words, you can only get facts through by attaching it to a very strong left-wing, right-wing, Christian, atheist position. Only if you establish your bona fides with this particular community, will they be open to facts. And surely coming from a paper like the AFT, but also from a tradition of journalism, which says there is such a thing as truth, which may never, of course, be fully realized, but it exists as an ideal, like the Holy Grail, to which you are always traveling, and which, when produced, will allow men and women of different points of view the ability to say, yes, that is at least a sketch. A sketch which is never complete, but is trying to say, here is something close to what happened, which is selected from the vast multiplicity of events, opinion, and so on, something which is a skeletal representation which people of goodwill can agree on. And that kind of journalism, I think, is still precious, will continue to be precious, and I think has an audience. The big journalistic centers, big newspapers, the BBC above all, perhaps, big broadcasters who have put their stuff on the web, have now got vast audiences. So The Guardian, which is the best example in the UK, has got 4 million readers of some kind, hits a month. Yet its circulation, which was 400,000, is now declining toward 300,000. And, of course, the business model is a problem, but the audience is not. And within that, that's where our discussion is centered, that that we've got an awful lot of people who want some kind of news which they trust. And trust by, you know, that someone on the right reading the Guardian account would say, yeah, well, that's true. I don't like the Guardian's opinion, but that's true. And that, I think, will exist, does exist. Journalism will continue to serve it. At the same time as you're getting what Mark's describing, a much more intensely argued, popular world in which journalism is presented as attached to a particular worldview, and the facts adduced underpin and support that worldview.
Mark Carter, how do you measure the appetite for the general view, the, should we say, broad, lowercase Republican sense of the world?
Well, I think John has put his finger on the crucial issue. I think one of the reasons that The Guardian is more influential than ever is precisely that Rupert Murdoch owns so many of the other, you know, major news outlets, including what used to be considered the objective newspaper of record, the Times of London. And in every country I've been able to look at, you know, when this occurs, when there's, shall we put it, the impression that major media are serving a particular agenda instead of a general agenda, there is a market space created for people who are, in fact, closer to what people recognize as a neutral position, even if it's more or less strongly argued. They recognize the quality of the information. I think one of the crucial things that's going to make the success or the failure of organizations is the degree to which their information is perceived as unique, as differentiated, and as not necessarily exclusive, but as reliable. Okay, so there is no question at all that major news organizations that have those capacities will continue to play a major role. The question then becomes, how do they monetize it? And that's, you know, that's a head breaker. And John, you know, I will admit to you that I don't have a quick answer to that one, and it's the one that keeps me up at night.
You and me both, brother.
J- John Lloyd, it's your question. Who's willing to pay for an authoritative view?
Well, clearly, the area that I've been in for some years, the kind of, if you like, business, economic, financial, international news of the Financial Times and The Economist, people will pay a premium. The Financial Times markets here in the UK at 150. That's double, almost, what the next most expensive paper, which is The Guardian, at 80 pence. The Economist costs, you know, well over £3. And to take out a subscription for either is, you know, on even on a relatively good income, is appreciable. To fork out 150 is not loose change. It's, you know, it is a discretionary purchase. So there clearly will be a market, is a market, for the kind of information which is useful to business, to making money, and to understanding the world in some depth. And more than that, the more expensive media, which are specially tailored to your particular needs, come out at, you know, hundreds or thousands of pounds, special reports and so on. That has existed for some time, will continue to exist, and in a way gives a bit of a free ride, because The Economist and the FT, although they have to a very substantial degree a business audience, also provide a lot of international news, social news, political news, which, where they separated from their business bit, would not sell in itself, or at least not in sufficient quantities, to keep the network of, above all, foreign correspondents, editorial writers, specialists, and so on, going. So they are doing a kind of public service, as it were, on the back of a business audience. Beyond that, I think that we are going to have to find some ways of, as Mark says, monetizing people's desire for truth, investigation, revelation, and an understanding of the world. And I think we're beginning to see it. Interestingly, the examples he gave during the session came very often from the NGO world. Again, not a new thing, that to rich people subsidizing particular kinds of information media is rather old. However, it is what's keeping very good magazines going. It's now through these the centers in universities, subsidized by people like MacArthur and Pew and Poynter and so on, keeping journalists in the field. What we're going through, I think, is a kind of a gulch, which at the other end of which may be, hopefully will be, a viable market system of providing what we would regard as good news. What had been the case, that virtuous cycle that newspapers had, that newspapers provide eyeballs, they sell the eyeballs to the advertisers, the advertisers then pay for the newspaper, which then sell the eyeballs, and so on. That wonderful, virtuous for us, and I think for the public, cycle, which has been going for two centuries, is now failing, and doesn't seem to be a temporary failure. So we've got to find another way of getting the eyeballs to people who will pay us money to do what we regard as a public service.
Mark Hunter, I keep wondering, who accrues authority in across the gulch, in internet world? What will mark the brands of authoritative judgment about our world?
Well, there it depends on a lot of factors. I mean, clearly the BBC and the Financial Times enjoy the benefits of that long heritage they have of trying to get it right. I mean, that does matter to people, and it's one of the reasons that these are news organizations that are currently setting not only a national news agenda, but they're setting a global agenda. When people get together, okay, in the international business world, they talk about what's in the Financial Times. You know, so these are important functions. I don't know of any internet site that is playing that role. What is happening at lower levels, well, not lower levels, but let's say smaller levels, you know, within certain communities of interest, is that you see voices emerging from within those communities that do set the agendas within the communities. Now, that can be very good, okay, because it means that they will have been effectively vetted by a kind of peer review. But it can also be very bad, because the pressures on people who belong to a community not to violate the canons or dominate ideas within those communities can be fierce.
Of course, also, of course, in the journalistic community, that one can get packs of journalists going after one thing. Yeah. And to break that pack mentality can be rather dangerous. Not dangerous, I mean, it can be uncomfortable.
John Lloyd, what are your favorite examples of, in a sense, community voices that a gaining authority, gaining interest, fascination for you?
Well, I mean, the ones which, you know, which are bear upon our present discussion, there's not, I mean, a huge efflorescence, as of course in everything, but in sites about journalism. And although one did have in America, United States, because of a century, really, of having journalist schools, which was absent in Europe until the 60s, virtually, you had then a public discussion, plus a constitutional commitment to free speech. There was a public discussion about journalism and the news media, which was to a large extent absent in the rest of the world, mm-hmm. and still is much less in the rest of the world. But what's happened, led by the United States, but now in Europe and indeed everywhere, in China, in Russia, in places where journalism operates under some quite severe constraints, you are having a conversation about how you have a conversation. You're having a conversation about how you do the facts, a conversation mm-hmm. essentially about journalism. And, I mean, because I'm interested in it and it's part of my day job, I use these places a good deal, and one sees in them the beginnings of something which we have not had, certainly in European journalism, and that is a questioning of the way in which we tell the story, or a questioning of the way in which we question, and the results we get. It's been quite astonishing, really, now, from this perspective, to reflect that for much of my journalistic career, and people older and people younger than me, there has actually not been a kind of a prompt in public discourse to look at the way in which you do journalism. And there was an old Fleet Street now gone, but I mean the national newspaper adage, which was dog does not eat dog, which meant, of course, that journalists should not expose the horrible way that other journalists did journalism, because they would do the same to you.
As Bismarck said, those who love the law in sausages should never watch the fabrication of either.
That is exactly true, because there might be some dog in it. Yeah.
No, you're making a really critical point. I mean, one of the things I'm thinking about is how journalism is a service rather than a product. And one of the key things about service is that it's where you interact with the customer.
Yes.
And so what you're doing at that point of interaction is very visible. And hardly anything that journalists do is visible.
You mean in the way in which they do journalism? No, that's absolutely right. And actually, we've been discussing today some interesting issues about how you badge journalism and how you give journalism a transparency by, as it were, almost attaching to it the ability, the tools by which to interrogate it. Now, it sounds cumbersome. It probably is cumbersome, but if you had that ability to, in some way, both by your own devices and aided by technology, to look at the sources. How did this guy get to write what he wrote? Where were his sources? How reliable were his sources? Even what's he done before? Can we trust him? You're going to transform over time journalism, because journalists then find themselves in the position that public officials, politicians, and others in public life have long found themselves, that is, the object of investigation, of routine investigation, of routine interrogation as to why are you saying what you're saying, Mrs. Clinton? Well, why are you saying what you're saying, Mr. Journalist?
May we see your notes, Mr. Journalist?
What?
May we see your notes?
Yes.
Well, actually, if a libel suit is filed against you in the United States, they can see your notes.
No, indeed, here too, yeah.
Here as well.
A lot of people think they should see his notes, or her notes.
Well, I'll tell you, it makes you very careful about what you put in that notebook.
Well, you mean you might leave stuff out? I mean, there is the argument, of course, about transparency, as an argument, I guess, but a lot of people adduce this, and it's not a stupid point, and that is the more transparency you put upon any process, the more, say, that all minutes of cabinet meetings have to be posted immediately or soon after, rather than after 30 years, which is the rule here, then actually the real business is done outside.
That's happened in the Bush administration. Yeah, I heard Seymour Hersh say that this summer. He's doing coverage at those levels, and that's what he's discovered.
Yeah.
His quote was, "Documents are dead."
Yeah. But I think the same now, I mean, at a less contested level, the Swedes have had a rule for some time that all government business, which is either written down or on email, can be open to to inquiry. And it is a commonplace in Swedish journalism and public life that the really, really delicate stuff is outside of the anywhere where people are taking notes or where a public record can be held.
Yeah. If we were to apply more transparency to journalists, I mean, I think this is going to happen if we see more journalism that's based in communities of interest and that's coming out of it for several reasons, one being that the journalists are just going to get a lot better known. I'm sure you had a stint as a local journalist, okay, and you know that when you work in the village, everybody in the village knows everything about you, and I think we're going to start seeing that applied in the kind of jobs that we all aspired to when we got out of the village.
So the village, I mean, it takes a village. I started actually writing when I was a schoolboy in the local weekly in my area, which was an area of villages, and I wrote a story which brought to the newspaper editor, who was also the owner of the sub-editor and the chief reporter, and said, "This is a great story." And he said, "I'm never going to publish this." And I said, "Why? It is true." And he said, "That's exactly the point. A community which wishes to cohere, and maybe that's no longer true, but it certainly was true, that which saw itself as cohering in a certain way, with a certain ethos, a certain morality, actually operated, and possibly still does operate, in quite unself-consciously in suppressing certain things. Certain things are best not said, like in the family. You know, don't talk to Uncle Albert about this because it'll just get him mad. Communities can be quite repressive, but it's certainly true that they do know you.
Well, you're touching on a really central issue, and that is what justifies that you tell stuff that can get people upset. And since Daniel Defoe, the justification has been that you got to talk about vice to get to virtue. You know, that you've got to talk about vice to stop it, etc. I don't know if Defoe was serious about that. He may just have been trying to save himself from a trial, but anyway, that's the claim people have made, and I think those kind of things are going to get tougher. Those kind of decisions are going to get tougher when journalists are attached to communities.
Yeah.
On with the transformation, onward through the gulch. Thank you, Mark Hunter and John Lloyd.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Marsha Lipman edits Pro et Contra, a policy journal published by the Carnegie Moscow Center in Russia. What is the internet effect in Russia so far? And to what degree do you find Russia becoming an internet society?
Well, the number of users is growing very quickly. Of course, there is a world of opportunities for people who want to know, for people who want to exchange, to reach out to their counterparts someplace else. However, what is important to me as an observer of the Russian political and public scene is to what extent these opportunities can be used to change the political reality in Russia. Mm. And here, I think the potential of the internet is negligible, just like of traditional media, just like of various other social political tools that can influence the political reality. The thing is that today in Russia, the Kremlin, the presidency, is the sole source of policymaking, and under the circumstances, if you are a committed journalist, if you still want to do things right, hold the government authorities to account, do investigative reporting, you have a voice, but this voice doesn't make a difference. That's the main thing. And this is true of traditional media as well as the new media.
How long can that go on, to have voices but not influence?
Actually, I think it can go on for a long time. The Kremlin has been very sophisticated. The Kremlin has thoroughly taken under control mass audience media, which is television broadcasts, national television networks. They are very thoroughly controlled. And this is a tool that has a capacity to influence the public opinion, unparalleled to anything else. There is a whole realm of media that pursue independent editorial lines, dailies and weeklies, and various online outlets, and even minor television channels, and a radio station that is very important in Russia. However, they've been marginalized. Hmm. The Kremlin tolerates them, but they're all at the mercy of the Kremlin. As if the Kremlin wants to, it can move against them, and there is nothing to stop it. This is the environment. The Kremlin has encroached on the public realm consistently through Putin's tenure, and the public readily gave in and did not show any resistance. If we look at the part of the world where media function, I would say the way they should, there is this one reporter, let's say, who discovers Abu Ghraib, and he reports Abu Ghraib. Next thing happens, all other media pick it up. Next thing happens, it becomes an item of broad public discussion. Next thing happens, it is in Congress. Legislators are talking about it. And then eventually they can summon high-ranking officials to give account. Accountability is the key word. In Russia, what happens is somebody may report his story, but that's the beginning and the end of the process.
It's so interesting. It didn't happen that way in the United States around Abu Ghraib. Dan Rather broke a story on CBS, Cy Hirsch in the New Yorker magazine. Dan Rather was out of a job within a year. And the Abu Ghraib story, starting, I think, in February or so of 2004, did not become a campaign issue, much less a big congressional issue either.
Well, but I think during Abu Ghraib, officials were summoned to Congress, and there were hearings, and they were forced to give account. And this eventually contributed, I think, to a decline of President Bush's popularity. One may argue Katrina contributed a lot more, but Abu Ghraib did it. And I think it contributed to what people thought about the current administration coming to its end shortly. So I think it may have not become a campaign issue, but a broader issue of Iraq war has become, and one, it's hard to measure to what extent Abu Ghraib contributed to the Iraq war becoming one of the main issues, but it certainly did contribute.
Marsha Lipman, what is the culture, what's the tone, the spirit, the politics of the internet community in Moscow? What do they talk about? What do they want to talk about?
Well, I think they would talk about all sorts of things. Well, to give just one example, we had the terrible tragedy of Beslan, the September 2004 horrible terrorist attack, terrible, monstrous terrorist attack. The scope of this tragedy was in large part as a result of sloppy rescue operation and of all sorts of irresponsibility operation by the Russian authorities. There is enough evidence for it on the internet, quite enough information for people to figure out that the official report is not necessarily truthful or complete. But again, the Kremlin has the capacity to stifle it, not by prosecuting or persecuting or even harassing
or censoring, apparently.
Or censoring. You could get this information, but it didn't make any difference policy-wise. There was even a parliamentary commission investigating it, except that that commission was, at the end of the day, loyal to the Kremlin authorities. This is just one example out of many. There is a lot of free discussion going on, and quite a lot of grumbling and quite a lot of discontent over what goes on. Just recently, we had a very unpleasant and very alarming development in St. Petersburg, where a university was actually forced to vacate their offices, and now its license has been suspended. There is a letter signing campaign of sympathizers with the university because there is a very good reason to believe that the reason behind it was political. But again, this It's like there is debate, there is a conversation, there is a discussion, but to me it is increasingly similar to the sort of discussions we had in our kitchens in the 70s during stagnation days, when there was a lot of discontent and lots and lots of the Soviet people had nothing but derision and resentment for the half-alive octogenarians who ruled the country.
This is Brezhnev time.
Brezhnev's times. But it didn't go any further. Hmm. In those days, of course, our venues were confined to our kitchens. These days, you can have even conferences, like at Carnegie Moscow Center, where I work. We have serious political conferences discussing sensitive issues. You can have media outlets that pursue independent editorial lines. We have, of course, the space of the Internet where people can exchange opinion. But the Kremlin has been able to marginalize all this to the extent that the Kremlin is not facing any opposition and any challenge. The Kremlin authority today is unchallenged and unchecked.
There was a fascinating piece in the New York Times this past week about Russia, and then a follow-up piece from bloggers in Russia, or responding on a Russian blog. The story, in short, was that Clifford Levy of the New York Times had written a big classic New York Times takeout on Putin's version of totalitarianism in Russia. It ran in the Sunday New York Times, but Friday before, a Russian translation of it was put on a big Moscow website, and thousands of people responded. And then, to my amazement, the New York Times published excerpts of the Russian commentary. This seemed to me a breakthrough, partly just in terms of the way the New York Times reports, first with a sort of Bigfoot journalist and then with the people responding. But also it was a revelation to me of a tremendous energy of Russian opinion dying to be heard on a New York Times site.
Yes, indeed. I think this was a really terrific idea for the New York Times to have that piece translated and posted. It's not even a website. It's they posted it in a big blogging community, the biggest blogging community in Russia. And the response was very intense, and the overwhelming majority of those responses were anti-American, very angry. Not unexpectedly, because this is the pervasive sentiment in Russia vis-a-vis the United States and even broader, the West. I think it was very interesting that the New York Times chose to translate them back, I think nearly all of them, and then make a selection of those and put it on paper in the actual issue of the New York Times for the American community to see how the Russians feel about a critical view from the outside, about the very fact that Americans are looking at Russia with an observant eye, so to say, and maybe get a better sense of how the Russian people feel, of how, in fact, it's not just a bad regime or a bad leadership of the country that's anti-Western, but get a sense of how genuine anti-Western sentiments are. In this sense, I think it is really enriching the knowledge, first and foremost, of the American reader about the sentiments of the Russian people. But also, I think it gave an opportunity of an exchange, a very rare instance of exchange between a Russian community and an American community. To me, it was even reminiscent of the TV bridges that were launched in during Perestroika days, when television audiences, groups of viewers, could see each other and actually talk to each other via a TV bridge. But in those days, that was before the internet, so those people had to be picked up and moderated by anchors on both sides. In this case, it's a freer exchange, unmoderated, and people are not specially picked up. They engage themselves, which to me is very important. I think that if this experiment will continue and maybe will be picked up by other publications, well, this may sound a bit idealistic, but maybe this would bring people closer to understanding each other. In my view, there is a shortage of good and insightful pieces about Russia written in the American media, There is clearly not enough understanding of what goes on in a country. There is a tendency to oversimplify things, and experiments like this one maybe can help this problem, if just a little bit.
The Russian response was fascinating at two levels, I would say. First, people were patriotic, a little defensive, feisty, contra the New York Times. Who's America to be sort of snooping and reporting on us? But in a larger way, it was very, very American. I mean, this is the way Americans would talk if they had a chance to talk back to, say, a Russian investigative report on us. So we heard their voices, in effect, as ours. But the other point is simply that as a journalistic device, to go into a country and say, here's what seems to me is going on, but now let's turn the camera around and let the natives speak in our language to us, that seems to me a whole new way of doing journalistic business. It's very, very promising.
I agree. I think this is a terrific idea, and I think it was done very well. They picked the right blogging community because that was a good way toward generating a huge amount of response. It will be very interesting to see whether this will be picked up. American readers also responded, and that was translated into Russian for the Russian people. So it's generated a lot of exchange among people, I think, among each of the two communities and between the two communities.
Yes.
I think this is, of course, very time-consuming, and it's costly because the translation was really prompt and quite good, actually very accurate, I think, from what I could see. We cannot expect every publication to do this with their pieces,
no.
With their foreign coverage, but it is interesting.
We can expect the Internet conversation to go on, and surely you expect the Internet community to grow in Russia. Imagine 10 years down the road with people blogging, expressing themselves, talking back. What do you think the Internet effect will be in Russia by, say, 2020?
Well, to me, more important is not just the Internet effect. According to Russian Internet experts, this audience is largely confined to big urban centers, and they account for maybe about less than half of the Russian population, some 50 million out of 140 million. However, this is still a very big, big community of people. But it is my strong belief that technology alone doesn't change political systems. It takes a popular drive. It takes a drive toward activism, toward a desire to make a difference, toward a desire to self-organize, to assume part of the responsibility of how your country is, not delegate it fully to the authorities and be passively compliant with what they do. The government has pushed people farther and away from politics and policymaking, and people have accepted this. Now, if politicization comes back, then I'm sure Internet will be a huge factor.
Marsha Lipman, it's been a pleasure to talk with you and to hear you on Open Source. Thank you.
My pleasure.
These conversations in London at the start of March 2008 were edited in Providence, Rhode Island by Paul McCarthy. Please join the conversation with a comment on our website, www.radioopensource.org, or close the feedback loop to me directly by email to chris@radioopensource.org. Let's keep the conversation going.